I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver. This is the commentary.ca. One of the country's finest writers joins me now. Roy McGregor is on again to discuss his newest book, Northern Light, The Enduring Mystery of Tom Thompson and the Woman Who Loved Him. It's an engrossing book, reading like a novel in parts, about one of Canada's iconic artists, Tom Thompson. This tells Thompson's story, namely it breaks down the mystery of his death. In July 1917, at the age of 39, Thompson's swollen body was found in Canoe Lake in Ontario's Algonquin Park. Since then, there's been a fierce debate as to whether it was a murder, a suicide, or an accident. He was buried at the lake, and in 1956, his remains were exhumed and buried in Leith, Ontario, where it's a major tourist draw today. In this book, McGregor looks at Thompson's relationship with one Winifred Traynor, what sort of relationship it was, and whether she was carrying his child. This book is such a fascinating read because it has everything: art, mystery, forensics, romance, a cover-up, maybe murder, suicide perhaps. Roy McGregor is an award-winning writer and columnist for the Globe and Mail. He is an officer of the Order of Canada, and his previous books have been bestsellers as well as prize nominees, if not winners, too. He was last on for his book, Canadians, A Portrait of a Country and Its People, one of my favorite books of all time. He was also related to Winnie Traynor. Northern Light is published by Random House from Toronto this day. Please welcome back to the Plant Online program, Roy McGregor. Good morning, Mr. McGregor.
Nice to be back, Joe.
Thanks for joining us. So at the time of Thompson's death, so for someone like me who's unfamiliar with art and that part of Thompson's life, at the time of his death, had he sold many paintings?
He had two big sales, one for $500, one for $250. He used all of that money to buy camping supplies and a canoe, and he loaned some of the money. But more than that, he was selling small sketches, and just before he died, he had sent a friend in Toronto a letter saying that he had some sketches. He hoped that the fellow might move for him because he was low on supplies, and the quote was, "If you can get $12 to $15 for them, that would be great, but take whatever you can get."
Wow. Now, was he regarded as a great artist at the time?
No, he was not known within art circles. He was certainly seen as a promising artist, and they talked about him, but people in the park were so blissfully unaware of his stature as an artist that when he died, the superintendent just down the rail line didn't even bother coming up to check to see what had happened. And it wasn't reported, really, that he was an artist. The local paper said he was well-known to some around Huntsville, I remember.
Yeah, so I know that you dig his work, but in terms of what the critics and the academics say now, what does he mean to Canadian art?
He's become the great Canadian iconic painter. He's part of the national feeling of this country. He's like the CP Rail or Vimy Ridge in terms of turning Canada into a nation rather than a colony in the first part of the 19th century. So his status is far beyond just being an artist, and it's reached the point where he, just saying the name Tom Thompson, he evokes all kinds of thoughts and images to people, almost all exclusively to do with Canada and the wilderness of Canada.
Now, they say if he hadn't died, or if we didn't know what we know now from reading this book sooner, if we knew what we know in this book sooner, he would not have been as renowned.
That's what I believe. I believe that over time, the mystery and the art have intertwined, and they feed off of each other, and they build from each other, so that the mystery is part of the art, and the art is certainly part of the mystery. And so that the fact that he's still discussed these days, and still people wonder what happened and where he was buried, his smart art is better known, and his fame has never been higher than it is in 2010.
Now, how did he meet Winnie Traynor?
Well, they were, I dare say, almost girlfriend by default. She was probably the only single woman on Canoe Lake, and he was certainly a single man on Canoe Lake. He was known to be interested in women, and women tended to fall in love with him. He was tall, dark, handsome, mysterious, brooding, into nature, a pacifist. Men didn't always much care for him. My grandfather knew him and didn't like him at all, but women liked him. And Winifred Traynor was a comely young woman in those days, single into her early 30s at the time when he died. She would have been very, very keen to get married and move out from under the roof of her parents at that time.
Now, you mentioned your grandfather. You're related to Winnie Howe.
It's technically, you wouldn't call it a relation, because what it is my grandfather was a ranger in Algonquin Park, and his brother was also a ranger, a fire ranger, and later became a doctor. But his younger brother, Roy, after whom I'm named, married Marie Traynor. Marie was Winifred Traynor's sister. So that Winifred never did marry after she lost Tom, and she lost her parents then after that, and there was no one else in the family. So that the McCormick family, my mother's side of the family, basically became Winifred's family. And we were raised with her just down the street, knew her quite well. She visited our home, visited at our place in Algonquin Park, and we visited her place. So it was very much like the old maiden aunt kind of scenario. She did not marry, and she was quite eccentric, quite eccentric.
Now, you and your friends, you were kind of mean to her, weren't you?
Yeah, we called her a witch. We thought she was a witch. We played Nicky Nicky Nine Doors on her, knocking on the door and running away. We'd throw things at her door and avoid her at all costs because she had a sharp tongue and carried a heavy umbrella. I was at one point subjected to that umbrella. We were hitching on the backs of bumpers. This is before they put salt on the roads. And up the streets we would go on the back, hitching rides in the back of bumpers and back down. You'd slide off and then just slide along in the very slippery streets right into a snowbank. I hit a snowbank and suddenly thought that a car had plowed into the behind of me because I started getting pounded. And I looked up and it was Winnie with her umbrella. She said, "You're going to get it as soon as you get home, young man." So I raced home, blamed the whole episode on my friends, kind of confessed and everything, thought I was twice as smart as Winnie and outsmarted her, but she turned out to be a lot smarter than me because she never bothered to phone and I'd already confessed.
Yeah. When was it that you first knew about the connection to Thompson?
I have no awareness of that, so it had to be as a very young child. My grandfather referred to him as a lazy bum, and there seemed to be some kind of animosity toward him within some members of the family, all of which puzzled me almost all of my life. Was it because he drank? Was it because he didn't seem to have a real job? Was it because the women quite liked him? Was it because he didn't intend at all to follow through with his promise to marry Winnie? Or was it perhaps that he had already impregnated her, and when he died, she was left alone to try to deal with this child that ended up being born and adopted in Philadelphia? Perhaps. I have to emphasize that, Joe, perhaps.
Yeah. Now, you did go to Philadelphia, didn't you, to try to find if there was a baby?
I got all the documentation that I believed was required in the stipulation that they have in Pennsylvania and asked if they would open up the records so that we could see whether or not there had been anything. I'm not saying there was. I'm just saying we wanted to see whether or not something had happened, because after Tom died, she and her mother disappeared for the entire winter, right through till Easter of 1918, and the local paper reported a number of times that they were, quote, staying with friends near Philadelphia. Some of the old-timers in Huntsville said that she was at a home for unwed mothers, and so I was trying to find out if a baby had been born, if a baby had survived, and if it had been adopted, and where it might be, even though it would be 92 years old at this point. And they turned me away eventually. They said the only people that we can turn that information over have to be direct descendants of either the father or the mother. And, of course, since we can't prove that Tom and Winnie had a child, they left behind no descendants. So I guess that door will never be unlocked.
So I read somewhere that you'd been thinking about all this for about 40 years, right?
Yes, at least that, because I started researching Tom Thompson in the early 1970s. And in 1980, I published a novel about Tom Thompson and Winifred Traynor. But one of the things that I had done at the time, fortunately, was I'd interviewed dozens of people who are now no longer with us, and sadly. But I kept all those interviews, and then when I returned to it in the last several years to start writing, I found that I had interviews with people that were absolute treasures and shed different light and new light on the whole murder scene. And then people, sorry, I said murder because I believe it was murder, but I also was given some documentation from people who had noted what they thought had happened or knew had happened and asked that it not be revealed in their time, and they were now passed away, so I'm able to use that in the books now.
So you say you think it's a murder. You ruled out suicide. One supposition is that he killed himself after he found out that she was pregnant with, she was with child.
Well, I don't know how one kills oneself with a body blow to the left temple that is so sharp that it leaves a hole in the skull, and then one wraps fishing line 16 to 17 times around your left ankle, presumably tied to a weight to keep you down at the bottom of the ocean just in case you haven't done a good job of killing yourself. So I've never taken the suicide theory seriously at the fact that a body did not surface till eight days after he disappeared in 1917, and when it surfaced, it was there was blood coming from one ear, there was no water in the lungs, and there was a terrible bruise over his left temple and fishing line wrapped around the ankle. And his paddle was never found. It was missing. So how did he even get out there in his canoe? It would seem that somebody towed his canoe out with his body in it and dumped it overboard with a weight tied to the ankle. That's what I believe, and that's what I think most people in close to the investigation and the story believe.
So he was his body washes up 8 days later, and he's buried at Canoe Lake. How do we know what the state of the body was in, like his fishing line and the blow to the head?
A ranger was there at the time, Mark Robinson, who kept very, very detailed journals. Plus, there were a number of other people there, a medical practitioner who examined the body and filed a report. Because it was summer, warm water, the body was decomposing quickly. They were waiting for a coroner to arrive from North Bay. He didn't come, so he was out there. They tied the body to a root on an island, covered it with a blanket. He was out there all day, and his friends got so upset about it, they asked the superintendent of the park if they could bury their friend. He acted as ex officio coroner, signed a paper that said, yes, you can. He was buried, and then the coroner arrived. The coroner filed this report saying accidental drowning without ever having seen the body.
So you think it's a murder. Do you think it's this guy Shannon Fraser?
Well, I was the first person to point the finger in Shannon Fraser's direction. I did so because in 1977 I found a woman called Daphne Crombie who said that Shannon Fraser's wife Annie had confessed to her at one point. This woman had been at Canoe Lake, had been a good friend of Tom Thompson. She said that Annie confessed to her that Shannon had killed him in a fight. They were fighting over money. Tom needed money. He had to get married. And he tried to get the money back from Shannon, and Shannon had owed him. They'd been drinking, and Shannon hit Tom. He was a big man, Shannon, big hands, and Tom went down and struck his temple on the fire grate, which would explain the puncture. In this new book, I have produced another witness who claims that he overheard Annie Fraser say the same thing to his parents, and his parents always knew the secret. And this, it's very basically the same story, Shannon Fraser going at Tom, and then Shannon used cover of night and had his wife Annie help him go out and dispose of the body. I mean, it was an accidental thing, so it would probably be manslaughter, but it certainly was foul play.
So what was the, so he's buried at Canoe Lake, and then in 1956 he's exhumed and moved. What was the deal behind that? Who decided that?
What happened was that they buried him right away because, of course, he was decomposing badly, and they put him in the ground at Canoe Lake. The family wasn't even there at the time, and then Winifred Traynor, acting on behalf of the family, arranged the following day for undertaker to come up from Huntsville and exhume the body and ship that body back to Owen Sound so it could be buried at the family plot at Leith. He came up, he worked alone through the night. Somehow he managed to unearth a body that was down 6 feet, that was badly decomposing and very, very heavy, with bloating with water. Got it into a steel casket, somehow sealed the casket as was required by train, got it on the train, delivered it to the Thompson family that week. They then buried the casket, absolutely convinced that their son was in it. And for the next, 93 years, it has been argued whether or not he was buried at Canoe Lake or buried at Owen Sound. However, in 1956, four men went up to the little cemetery at Canoe Lake with shovels, dug around, and on the third try they found a box, and the box had a skeleton in it, so they naturally presumed that they had found the remains of Tom Thompson. In fact, the skull that they found had a hole in it right in the left temple, right where it had been noted that Tom was so badly bruised when he surfaced. And papers were all over this story saying that they had finally found Tom Thompson, we knew where he was. And then the next thing you know, the forensic scientists for the Attorney General of Ontario are announcing that, no, it's not Tom at all. It's some young 20-year-old Aboriginal who just happened to have had a medical procedure, a rare medical procedure called a trepanation, done on that part of the head to relieve pressure, presuming the Aboriginal at one time had a stroke. And that was the end of it. And a lot of people around Canoe Lake, including me, never for a moment believed that this was the true story, that they had in fact unearthed Tom Thompson, but there had been a cover-up.
So when you, this is the skull that you had the photograph of, right?
Yes.
Well, what happened to the remains?
after they did this investigation in Toronto, they returned. They tell me that the remains were all returned to Canoe Lake and buried in the same plot that they had been taken from in 1956. So, what I found was I was given a photograph of the skull that was taken in 1956, in the moment that they unearthed it and brought it up. And it was given to me by a family, the Statton family in Canoe Lake, who always believed that Tom had never been moved. Then I was able to use that photograph and other photographs of the skull that the Attorney General's Department had taken in 1956, and I was able to provide them to Dr. Ron Williamson of the University of Toronto and his team of scientists. They're all archaeologists and pathologists and bone experts, and what they are particularly adept at is the forensic identification of remains. They have identified Civil War soldiers. They have identified people who were hung in prisons and buried in paupers' graves. They have the expertise, and they also had 2010 CSI-level science working for them, computer programming, image resonating. They had everything that you could imagine that wasn't available in 1956. And after they had examined it for a number of weeks, they concluded, four different scientists said that there's no way that the skull could be anyone else but Tom Thompson. They subsequently got North America's leading forensics artist, Victoria Lywood, out of Montreal. She specializes in aging children, you know, that kind of art that we're talking about, and putting faces to remains.
Right.
She worked blind. They didn't tell her a thing about who she might be illustrating. She just worked from the photographs of the skull that we were able to provide. She built a face and delivered that back to Ron Williamson. He then sent me a email, and he said in the email, sit down, pour yourself a drink, take a Valium, and open up the file. And I did, and I was looking at Tom Thompson's identical twin.
Yeah. Now, who paid for all this?
They largely did it on a volunteer basis, and I would have to suggest tens to hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of science went into this, but they just got so curious and fascinated by the tale that they did it on a voluntary basis.
Who do you think's buried in Owen Sound? Or at
Nothing.
Owens? Nothing?
Nothing in the casket.
Yeah. You met this guy, I guess in the 70s, Jimmy Stringer?
Yes.
Yeah, he seems like just such a fascinating guy.
Well, Jimmy, I knew him all my life.
Yeah.
My family came from Algonquin Park, and we grew up with the Stringers and their legends. Jimmy was drinking one day in Huntsville and tried to convince me that he had Tom Thompson's shin bone hidden in his shed back at Canoe Lake. And this was in the winter, and he made me a promise that come the good weather, we'd dig up the actual grave, and he'd show the world where Tom really was buried. I don't know whether he had any shin bone or anything like that, but nonetheless, the next day he heads out to return to his home at Canoe Lake, and he had his supplies with him, and he was taking them over by toboggan across the water. It was an early spring thaw, and he went through the ice not far from where Tom Thompson drowned, or surfaced anyway, and he drowned in Canoe Lake himself.
He never got to see the shin bone or anything like that, right?
No. All I could do, and subsequently, now that I've learned that Tom really was at Canoe Lake, I've wondered many times, was Jimmy pulling my leg and talking about Tom Thompson's leg, or did he actually know something? It seems to me possible that he did know something.
Yeah. When Winnie died, there's a story in the book about you had to help clean up the house, did you?
Mm-hmm.
What was that like? I mean, thinking about it now, I mean, you probably would have done something to keep some of the stuff, maybe? I don't know what. That's what I was thinking when I was reading it.
Well, I was 14 or 15 years old, and I didn't have the wherewithal to take notes or take photographs or anything. I sure wish I had. She was extremely eccentric. She lived in the top floor. She never did marry. She died at age 77 in 1962, lived in the top floor of the old family home in Huntsville, very close to us. And, you know, she wouldn't have let the tenants below paint the living room walls because, they'd been painted by Tom Thompson. She gave them a small deduction on their rent if they agreed to cut her toenails once a month. She had 13 Tom Thompson originals wrapped in newspaper and stuffed in a 6-quart basket that she hardly ever looked at. Now they'd be worth $2 million apiece, and yet this woman wouldn't even allow herself running hot water. She had, if she had lived today, she'd be on that television program called The Hoarders, where she kept everything, and you could hardly make your way through the house, and we were cleaning it up for magazines and newspapers. Paint cans piled in the bathtub that had not been used because, there, as I say, there was no running water. And just utter eccentricity, which made me all the more fascinated with her, I have to confess.
Yeah. This book reveals a great deal. Does it change anything with regards to how we look at Thompson?
It should change a little bit in terms of people wondering where he is, and, you know, people who are particularly fans of Tom Thompson, they often go to Canoe Lake to visit the cairn, the memorial cairn that's there. Well, now they know they're also visiting the lake where he's buried at. In terms of how we view his art, I think it just continues on. It's the mystery. It probably will never know precisely what happened to him. I think I take an awfully good guess in speculation in the book and provide lots of new evidence. But I'm one who doesn't really want that ever completely solved, because I think that knowing the story and talking about it and combining the mystery with the art is part of his legacy. And I really respect what his family says. Tracy Thompson, who's the great-grandniece of Tom Thompson, said the mystery and the art are together. They should be together, and they'll always be together. And she said, I, for one, hope that chatter never dies. I agree with her.
Yeah. Did you have fun writing this book?
I found it, I wouldn't want to say cathartic, but it was good for me to take all those interviews that I'd done for past years, 40 years of research, and put it all together. And then I have to confess, I've just really, really lucked into this science stuff with Dr. Williamson, and I could never have afforded this. No one could. It's just the enthusiasm of forensic scientists to try to get to the bottom of this that has, I guess, solved Canada's greatest mystery of all time.
It's such a wonderful book, Roy. Congratulations on it. Good luck with it. It's been delightful to talk again.
Thanks, Joe. It was good talking to you, too.
The book is called Northern Light, The Enduring Mystery of Tom Thompson and the Woman Who Loved Him. It's published by Random House. Its author, Roy McGregor, on the line from Toronto. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Planta.